Hello, everybody. Welcome to the review session for the quiz. So in today's session, we're going to cover, for those of you here for the first one for the test, we covered week 0 through 5. Today, we're going to cover week 6 through 10, again, at that same sort of high level that we did for the test, as well as provide you with some information on what to expect during the quiz. So here is the information that is perhaps most relevant for you. The information about the quiz has been posted on the course's website. It's linked on the front page. This quiz is 48 hours long, so for the test you had 72 hours. This time you're going to have 48 hours, so you should expect, though, that the quiz will be scaled down in proportion. So the test had 10 substantive questions plus the question about grade scope, so you should expect that the quiz will be scaled down accordingly. It'll be released tomorrow at noon, and it is due 48 hours later, Thursday at noon. Be sure to, it's gonna be the same format as the test, so you'll have a series of text files that you'll download. You'll write your answers in those text files. Even though you may see programming-related questions, do make sure to take your answers if you write them in other files and paste them into those the text files that we prescribe so that your quiz can be graded. Some of you may have noticed that on the test, if you wrote your answers in a different file, it was a little tricky for the staff to find them, because we're only going to import those files, so just make sure they all end up in the right spot. You'll submit via Submit 50. Do make sure to run Update 50 in your IDE beforehand so that it is up to date and ready to go, and you won't run into any troubles when you try to submit. Everything that we've covered in the course is fair game. The quiz will have an emphasis on the second half of the course from weeks 6 through 10 inclusive and problem sets 6 through 8 inclusive, but everything we have covered in the class is still fair game, so do be sure to review your notes from the first half of the course. And this also includes our lecture at Yale. That was the week 7 lecture. Hopefully you all watched that as well. The staff will be returning the quizzes to you after Harvard-Yale. So the test we returned later that night, but the quiz we're gonna be returning after Harvard-Yale. So expect that early next week. In terms of the resources available to you, they are much the same as they were for the test. So you're gonna wanna take a look at lecture notes, the lecture source code examples that David provided during class, the slides, rewatching the lecture videos to particularly in those areas where you feel you could use some refreshers in particular, as well as reviewing problem set specifications, distribution code, and postmortems. Postmortems for problem sets 6 through 8 are now available, or will very soon be available, particularly for 8, so you can take a look at those and compare your own solution to PSET 8 or to the other problem sets against the staff solution to see where things might have been. You might have had an opportunity to improve or do something slightly differently. We will have final office hours today. There are office hours still at HSA going on right now until 5:30 this evening, and we're going to have office hours tonight here at Harvard in Widener and at Yale in the AKW building. Check the office hours calendar. Here at Harvard, it's gonna be, I believe, 9 to 11 p.m. tonight in Widener, and at Yale, I think it's 7 to 9 for those of you at Yale watching. But check your check the course calendar, which has the most updated information on that. And you can feel free to go there and ask staff any questions about any topics covered in the entire course, and we'll do our best to answer and address those concerns before the test. There will be no office hours during the test, just as there were no office hours during the quiz. And in fact, we're actually going to be done with office hours after today, because at this point in the course, we've now transitioned to, in addition to the quiz, we have the final project. And everybody's doing different things, and so office hours will not be able to focus on a particular more narrow set of topics as we were able to do during the earlier portions of the course. Yes?
How is this quiz weighted in comparison to the other quiz that we did?
The test was weighted at 25% of your grade, and the quiz is 15% of your grade. CS50 Discuss, you can also post questions on CS50 Discuss through the end of the day today. Staff will be monitoring it. You may not post any questions during the quiz itself, and staff will not respond to any questions posted during that time. And just as was the case for the test during the quiz, the only humans to which you may turn for help are not your TF and not your fellow students, but only to the course's heads. And we'll answer any logistical questions that come up. Obviously, we can't answer any content-related questions that come up. But if you have a technical issue or perhaps find the wording of a question confusing, we can try and address that for you. But we can't answer any content-related questions during the quiz. You still have access to the quiz bank, which some of you may have used during the test to take a look at some of the past questions we have given. We also, in the test, gave out two sample questions ahead of time, so you get a sense of the format and style of questions. We're not going to be releasing any sample questions this time because now you're familiar, acclimated to the types of questions we're going to ask from having seen them on the test. And you can still look at the test. You can use the test and the test's answer key as resources. Of course, they are publicly available, so they're fair game for you to use as well. And you can access all of that information still. So you can still visit the test, see the actual test. And right after the test, David emailed out a sample answer key, and you're welcome to use that as well and consult that as a resource while taking the quiz. All right, any questions about any of the logistical stuff before we move on to the substantive content? Okay, so like I said, everything from the course is fair game. You may be expected to answer any questions from content in week one or two, possibly. We covered all of this during the test review session in October. I posted a link there to the video where we covered that session, so you can feel free to review that. There's also slides and stuff available on the course website, and you can use those as well to refresh on that portion of the course. So like I said, we're gonna move on from week six forward. And the first topic we talked about in week six was networking. So remember, at this point, we've now transitioned away from C, where we had spent pretty much the whole first half of the semester. And now we're transitioning to web-based programming, eventually Python, JavaScript. But we started that by talking about networking and what the internet actually is. And remember that the internet is not, as was famously said many years ago, a series of tubes. It's really a series of interconnected small networks. So we have networks in our home that are managed by routers. We have different devices connecting to them, and they somehow all funnel out into the internet. But the internet is really just other people's networks all over the place with connections between them. That's really all there is to it. And services run on the internet, relying on that physical hardware as we go. So if I'm sending a packet to Rob, maybe he's on one side of campus and I'm on the other. I send an email, it moves from router to router to router, finding a way to get to Rob, finding the best path to get there. But it's not just that maybe I'm sending him an email, maybe I can send him a picture. We're relying on the same infrastructure to do all of these different things, sending an email or sending or transferring a file or visiting his website if his website is hosted on a server in his room. We're using the same hardware to do it, but different services can rely on that same physical infrastructure to move data from one place to another. And like I said, the way we do this is via a router. So routers are those, you know, physical devices. They're sometimes pretty small. Sometimes you can just put them on your desk. Sometimes they're these giant banks of things that you'll see, and you'll see a couple of them hidden sort of in the rafters in here. And they are the devices that are sort of, they're the traffic cop. They see information coming into them. And that information has a destination, an IP address. Every one of our devices has an ostensibly unique IP address, and the router looks at that address and decides which way to send it. Maybe it's gonna send it right, or maybe it's gonna send it east, maybe it's gonna send it west to the next hop in the chain. And all of these routers, you know, we can abstract away exactly how they do this, but they have some concept of where certain IP addresses generally are, and so it knows generally which direction to move data to get it from point A to point B. And they support different protocols, and protocols are, remember, a standardization of transferring data from one machine to another. So we have different types of protocols. We have things like the HTTP, the Hypertext Transfer Protocol, which is used to transmit and read and understand web pages. We have the SMTP, Simple Mail Transfer Protocol, which is used to transmit and parse and understand emails. All of these services or all of these protocols, routers know how to support and send information through them. Another protocol that's really important is DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, and this is how we actually get an IP address. This is how, without DHCP, none of us would be able to send information from one to the other because we wouldn't have addresses. If you were trying to send me a letter, you would need to write my address on the outside of the envelope in order for it to get to me. DHCP is the digital equivalent of where you live. It's the digital equivalent of your address. And if you don't have a router that supports DHCP, it's never going to give you an IP address, and you'll never be able to actually access the internet. Now, ostensibly, the IP address that it gives you is going to be unique. But we sort of have this problem where we're running out of IP addresses. And this is a big issue. This is still ongoing now, and where the world took a really long time to figure out that this was a problem, and it's taken even longer to implement the solution. But the IP addresses that we're familiar with, perhaps from bad representations of them in the media or just from our own use of devices, maybe seeing IP addresses in the bottom corner or visiting a website and having it tell you your IP address, like an IP chicken or something, we are used to seeing this group of four numbers in the range of 0 to 255. That is an IP version 4 address. And each of these numbers is an 8-bit number. So we have four 8-bit numbers, or 32 bits, which means we can have about 4 billion unique IP addresses. The problem with that is that there are 7 billion people in the world. And up here right now, I have at least four devices. I have two in my pocket, my phone. We have the clearly, many of us have multiple devices. And so if everybody had a unique IP address for every single device that they had, we'd run out. And we have sort of kind of put the brakes on this problem with this notion of public IPs and private IPs. Private IPs being IP addresses that are specific to within your local network. So you may have noticed, if you've ever done configuration on your own networks, that when you check your own IP address, you'll see that it's like 192.168.1.106 or something, right? That is a private IP address. It is an IP address that only means something inside of your network. If Maria and I are on different networks, my private IP address could be .1.106. Maria's could also be .1.106. But because our router has the public IP address, so the router gets one public IP address for every device that it is routing traffic for, and then inside of the router it can handle figuring out that, oh, if you know Rob and I are connected to the same network, that Rob's iPhone was what sent this particular HTTP request, and my computer was what sent that HTTP request. The router can handle all of that. But that's how we've sort of dealt with this problem so far, is that we give ourselves private IP addresses and we allow our router or some other switch or something like that to have the one public IP address that many of us are sharing. But we are turning toward this notion of an IPv6 address, which looks a little different. There are now eight numbers separated by colons, and they go up to hexadecimal FFFF, which is 65,000 and such. And there are 128 bits, and we're not going to run out of those anytime soon. The problem is just getting everybody to agree that now is the time where we need to actually get rid of these archaic IPv4 addresses and switch to IPv6 addresses. So this is a problem that is ongoing right now. Questions on that so far? Okay. So DNS. DNS is the yellow pages of the internet, and probably none of you have actually used a yellow pages in a very, very long time. But the yellow pages used to be used. You look somebody up by their name, and it gives you their phone number. Well, the DNS is a very similar concept for IP addresses and mapping them to names that mean something. So every website that you visit has an IP address, but you probably don't type in http://, and then a set of four different numbers separated by a period, most likely. You usually would visit www.facebook.com or www.google.com. But it's only behind the scenes, thanks to the domain name system, DNS, that we are able to translate google.com into its IP address such that our browser can then send a request to that IP address. Remember, whenever we're transmitting data from one machine to the other, we need to know where it lives. We need to know its actual address. And just saying google.com, that's not my address, right? Like, if you're trying to send me a letter, you're not going to write on the outside of the envelope Doug Lloyd and drop it in a mailbox and just like hope that it gets to me, right? Like, you have to provide more information. You have to say like where I live as well. And so we have to do the same thing when we're sending any sort of request, whether it's a HTTP request or any request. We need to know the IP address of where we're trying to send that information. And that's what DNS helps us to do, to translate those IP addresses into more human readable names, and vice versa. We also have this cool tool called Traceroute, which some of you may remember from lecture, which allows you to see exactly what routers you hit along the way when you are visiting a page. So you can see exactly how and where your traffic is going and how long it takes to get there. And you may remember from lecture the example where we submitted a request and it crossed an ocean. And it took a very long time to do that because, go figure, it takes a long time to cross an ocean even if you're moving at the speed of light. So Traceroute is a tool that we have to be able to see exactly these steps that I described earlier of router to router connections, what IP addresses of all those routers are, and how they're sending data down the road. And then, so then we have this notion of TCP IP. And we've talked about IP addresses, but what we didn't say was that an IP address is an internet protocol address. And TCP is the transmission control protocol. And they work in tandem. Basically, the IP protocol was responsible for getting information from me over to Maria. It needs to figure out what steps it needs to take to pass information. That is IP's job, internet protocol's job. TCP's job is built upon that. And what TCP does is when I send information, say I want to send Maria a video. Maybe it's the MP4 of CS50's lecture, so it's 2 gigabytes, right? I'm not gonna just take one stab at taking this whole 2 gigabyte file and just be like, all right, like here we go, like hope that's gonna work. Because if it fails, which is gonna happen a non-trivial amount of time, that's a lot of data to have to resend. I tried, I failed, and now I have to send 2 gigabytes of information back over the wire and hope again that it won't fail a second time. So what really happens is we take information and we break it down into chunks, which we usually call packets. So instead of sending 1 2-gigabyte file, I might send 2,000 megabyte size files. A lot smaller, and probably I would go quite a bit smaller than that too, but so instead of sending that one packet, or excuse me, yeah, one huge packet, I'm sending 2,000 small packets, and maybe a couple of them fail. Well, what TCP does is it's listening on my computer, it's listening on Maria's computer, it's waiting to figure out, okay, well, it looks like I got 1,994 packets, but I'm missing 6 of them. And thanks to TCP, it actually numbers the packets and which and how to arrange them. So Maria's computer can then respond to me and say, well, actually, I didn't get packets 3 and 10 and all this stuff. And it can send another request back to me. And then my computer can send those 6 packets back to her again so that she can then reassemble them. So that's one thing that TCP does, is it breaks information into packets and it orders them. So it tells you how many packets to expect and in what order to reassemble them when they arrive on the destination machine. Because just because I send Maria packets 1, 2, 3, 4, she might receive them in the order 3, 1, 4, 2 because they took different routes or paths to get there. So TCP has to resort them into the correct position. And the other thing that TCP does is there are a lot of things running on our devices, right? If you were to take out your phone and like press the button or the little thing that shows you how many apps are running, you're probably running like 40, just because they all just keep running in the background forever. Like right now, I have PowerPoint going and I have services running in the background. Like there are all these different things. These are all happening, and basically what's happening is my computer is listening on different ports for different types of data to come in. And nothing's coming into my PowerPoint program, but I might get an email coming into something like a Thunderbird or some email client that I have. Maybe I have a browser open and it keeps submitting like AJAX requests to give me like the latest score on something, right? TCP is responsible for making sure that a packet destined for a particular program or a particular service gets there. So IP is responsible for me, for anything that I am sending, getting to Maria. TCP is responsible for breaking those things I'm sending down into smaller pieces, putting numbers on them, and making sure that if I'm sending something from my email client, it's getting opened in an email client. Just because it got to her computer, that's not enough. It also needs to then know where to send it, which port to send it to. That's what TCP and IP do when they're working hand in hand. This notion of ports, it's not like we have these different kinds of ports, and older computers used to have like many more of them on the side. That's not what we're talking about when we're talking about ports. They're a software-oriented concept more so. But there are a number of different kind of standardized ports that we send data on. So these are some of the common ones. These are some numbers to just keep in mind. These are all things that you can look up really easily, but if you have that at sort of the tip of your tongue, it might just save you a few seconds if you see a question about like what port something is being sent on. And there are many, many more. And these are ports that are standardized. across, you know, every basically manufacturer of computers has, and every service provider has agreed that, like, okay, well, we're going to send emails over port 25. But it's not to say that these are exclusive. So HTTP is typically sent over port 80. But if you recall from problem sets 7 and 8, we also had you do a lot of stuff on port 8080. And we told it that's what's going to be for HTTP requests. So typically traffic is going to be sent to port 80, but you can override or send it to different ports. If you go to a website and you type, www.google.com:80, so now you're saying I want to go to Google's IP address and I specifically want to talk to port 80. You can do that as well. In your browser, you can visit different ports. Weird things might happen if you're trying to use your web browser to access a port for SMTP or something like that, but you can actually do it. You can specifically go to a website and talk to a specific, you can go to any IP address and talk to a specific port. Okay, questions so far? Yes? Ports that are standardized are universal across all devices, and but the number of ports that there are, I think it's a 16-bit number, so it's like 65,000 ports. There's way more ports that people have not agreed on, and there are some ports. You can actually go to like a Wikipedia article on like common port numbers and see that there are actually a couple of services that conflict because the two service providers can't decide which one should be port, 43. I don't know what I can't think of one off the top of my head, but there are a number of ports for the most common basic services that we use that are standardized and are agreed by all service providers of that type.
Yeah, generally any port under like 1024 is standardized pretty well, and everything above 1024 is a free for all for whatever wants a port.
TCP is responsible for taking data and seeing to which port it should be directed.
Yeah, it's ultimately your operating system that when it receives a packet, it determines, okay, this packet is meant for Skype, this one is meant for Chrome, this one is meant for iMail.
Good question. Yes. Yeah, so when you visit a website, like if you visit Google, it's really just software that is running on some computer. And in the case of Google, it's software that's running on a lot of computers. Like Google has a lot of IP addresses. But really, at the end of the day, yeah, so you can start a website that's really just some piece of software that's running on your computer. Google just happens to be very large, but at the end of the day, it is still just the same type of thing that you did in PSET 7 and 8. It's a piece of software that's running on some machine somewhere, and that machine has an IP address. Pretty much, yeah. When you visit a site or you visit an IP address, you're talking to that machine, and in the case of visiting a website, you're sending an HTTP request, so you're sending it to that machine's port 80, and that port is configured to take your request, which is usually going to be something like, get /HTTP/1.1. So basically, the protocol of HTTP is to say, please give me a particular page or something on your machine, and it will respond and tell you, okay, like I'm sending you the page from my machine that you requested, and then it will send you all the HTML that comprises that page. But really it is just one machine talking to another saying, can you give me the page source for this, or can you give me the image source for this, and having it respond to you.
Yeah, if you think of all of the Python code that you wrote for PSET 7 and 8, that's basically what happens when you go to like google.com, is some Python code or equivalent runs and gives you a response that ends up looking like Google's homepage.
Yes?
So does that computer that's chilling there, does it have to be on all the time?
Yeah. If it's unplugged, if Google was one computer and they turned it off, there's no Google. Fortunately, Google has many, many computers and many, many fail-safes, but if you close out of your CS50 IDE, I can't visit that specific URL that you have. Mine would be like lloyd.cs50. I don't know exactly what it is, but something like that. If your CS50 IDE is, if you stop that service, and if I try and visit your site, it's like not found. Like, it doesn't know what it is. So if you turn off the power to it, it's not found. It doesn't exist anymore until you turn it back on. Yes?
So briefly, what are the steps that
Both. So if you are preparing a request, you visit on your browser, you go to www.google.com. That is really shorthand for the browser is then going to prepare an HTTP request based on what you just said. It's going to do a domain name service lookup for Google's IP address. It will send the information that you requested, breaking it up into packets via TCP, to that IP address, which will be listening on port 80 for an incoming request. When all of the packets that you send are received on Google's side, we'll just keep using Google for this example, they reassemble the request so that, because you had broken it into all these chunks, it needs to figure out exactly what you said in what order, looks at the request, decides whether or not it can process the request validly, prepares an answer for everything that you asked for. So maybe you want Google's homepage. So it prepares an HTTP response as well as the HTML that comprises Google's homepage. And then it does the exact same process in reverse. So then it sends, it takes the homepage, breaks it up into chunks via TCP, sends all of those to your port 80. Your browser is listening for a response because it has sent out a request, so it's gonna keep waiting to hear back. Your browser will then receive all of those packets, reassemble them, and then after it's done all of that, which is happening like this, right, blink of an eye, your browser will then fill in the page with what it received.
The only thing I would adjust with that is that it doesn't have to be, when Google responds to you, it doesn't have to be responding to port 80. So when I initially make that that request to Google, when I request from Google's port 80, I'm basically telling Google, okay, I want you to respond to port 1242.
Oh, that's true. You can override then, where it sends it.
Yeah, so Google will end up responding to 1242, and that's what will end up displayed in your browser. So ports are separate, like ports are lower level than necessarily HTTP. So port 80 generally means like the port 80 is the convention that a website uses port 80. So when you go to google.com, it will automatically fill in colon port 80 or colon 80. So 80 is always the default, but that's for the receiving end. And so when I request google.com, it will go to port 80, but Google's response back to me doesn't need to go to port 80. It just needs to go to any port on my laptop that is specifically listening for Google's response.
Which by default will be?
No.
No, it will not be 80?
No, because it would be 80, like if you were running an HTTP server on your laptop.
Oh, that's true. Because then I would be sending out, if I had a website running on my machine, I'd be listening on port 80 for incoming requests for you visiting my website. So that's true.
Yeah. But any response can go to any port as long as the web browser is appropriately listening to that port for the response.
Okay. So then we have, so with all this talk of ports, it lends itself to a good discussion about firewalls. And VPN. So firewalls are another kind of software that runs on your computer that can block incoming traffic. It can say, I'm receiving a request on port X, and my computer is deliberately going to block all requests on that port. So sometimes you might have that experience, or it can also just block addresses instead of just looking for ports. So firewalls are what happens, like if you're at work or something and you can't visit like Facebook, it's because your employer has set up a firewall to block all responses coming from Facebook's, or possibly even outgoing requests on your part to Facebook's IP address or responses from Facebook's IP address. And similarly, it can be used to prohibit, so you could have a firewall set up. If I was running a web service, or in the really bad example, Google is running its service, it's listening on port 80 for all responses, but somehow they've set up a firewall to block all incoming requests on port 80, Google's not gonna work anymore. Even though the service is running fine, the computer is on, it should be fine, it's listening on port 80. If somewhere else on my computer I am running a piece of software that's a firewall, it can intercept and it can basically like close the door at port 80. So all of these requests kind of like bounce off the door and they never get through. This is not necessarily that Google is failing to process your request, it's that some other piece of software has intercepted or blocked them. Sometimes governments do this, sometimes offices or workplaces do this, and usually it's for productivity reasons or some other legitimate reason, but sometimes it might be for a malicious or an illegitimate reason. And there also exist these pieces of software called VPNs, or virtual private networks, which can be used sometimes as a trick to get around firewalls. Because basically what I'm doing in that situation is, I want to visit Facebook, but my work is not allowing me to visit Facebook. So what I'm instead going to do is connect to my VPN, which is going to create this sort of like secure tunnel between me and, in the case of, you know, my VPN I commonly use at work, it's Harvard's VPN. And basically what happens then is all of my requests, all of my outgoing traffic looks like it's going to Harvard. It doesn't look like it's going to Facebook anymore. And it's all encrypted. And then at the other end of the tunnel, the VPN is then submitting my Facebook request on my behalf, but my firewall can't catch it because it seemed like it was a legitimate piece of outgoing traffic. And then all of that same stuff we talked about earlier is happening between the other end of my VPN tunnel, in this case, again, Harvard, and whatever I'm requesting. And this isn't just web traffic. This could be any type of traffic that might be blocked by a firewall. And then the response that comes back to me is coming from, again, Harvard in my case. And so it looks like I'm doing something, you know, that's on the up and up based on whoever set up the firewall, but I'm actually using, but I'm using a VPN to sort of get around these restrictions. VPNs can be used for lots of other different things too, but this is just, I put these two things side by side so you can see, like, I can put up a firewall. So I'm gonna say I'm gonna block all traffic from Facebook. So a VPN basically lets me say, well, I'm gonna trick you into making it look like my traffic is actually going to Harvard and not to Facebook, and I'll let the other end of the tunnel do the stuff that you don't want me to do. So that's the way around it. And I know we're spending a lot of time talking about week six, and that's because it's the oldest, it's sort of the oldest material that we cover, so we'll move a little bit more quickly through some of the stuff that's fresher, but I wanted to get you back up to speed on this one, especially where you didn't necessarily have a section on this stuff. HTTP requests come in a couple of different forms. There's GET, there's POST, there's plenty of others. GET and POST you've seen most commonly. But again, just to re-summarize what we were talking about earlier, the way that a request works is our computer prepares a request. It asks for a particular page, typically, that it would like, and then some other additional info, like what your own IP address is. It's sort of like putting the return address on an envelope so it knows where to send the information back to, and some other stuff that you might want to include. And then the server that is listening for that request prepares a response and delivers that response to any port on your machine that is listening for it so that your web browser can process it for you. But sometimes you're not always going to get what you want. If you get what you want, you'll never see that what has actually happened is you received the 200 OK, which is basically the status response of you visited google.com and you see Google's homepage. Everything worked out. That's great. 200 OK. What you might have otherwise seen, though, are some of these other numbers that I've put on the screen here, in particular 404, which would be the case of if Google was unplugged, you might get a 404 not found, because when it tries to submit a request, there's nobody there to hear it. It's sort of like shouting into the ether and expecting a response. You're not going to get one. It was not found, so you get a 404. You'll get a 401, which is unauthorized. So if you're trying to access a page, I believe, that requires login, but you are not logged in, you might get a 401, and if you log in and then try again, you might get a 200 OK because you're logged in, you're authenticated. You might get a 403, which is you're trying to visit a page that you're never going to be allowed to see, maybe because it's part of some work's intranet, or it's a page that you're just not supposed to see because it's only for the programmers who are using it. You know, it's a source code file or something, and you're trying to access it, you might get a forbidden. Even if you're logged in, you're never going to be able to see this. 500, the server screwed something up. So servers are not perfect, they're machines. Machines, like I was describing earlier, and I'm sending Maria information, maybe a packet gets dropped. Similarly, machines might have a situation where all of us all of a sudden visit one page, and we've certainly seen, we saw this a few weeks ago, what happened when all of us try and visit one page at the same time. It's sort of like the server's trying to do a juggling act, and then all of a sudden all the balls just drop to the floor because it can't. It can't keep everything in the air, it can't do everything. It's an internal server error, maybe, is what happens. And your request fails, but it's not because you did something wrong, it's because the server did something wrong. So you might see responses like that, too. And usually you can fix that by just waiting a second, trying again, or if the site is down, you might have to wait a little more than a second. But you can get different kinds. It's not that every request is automatically granted. You can encounter problems along the way as well. Finally, at the very end of week six, we introduced two new languages, neither of which is a programming language. This is a really important distinction. HTML and CSS are not programming languages. They are languages. The reason they are not programming languages is they do not have control flow. There's no if in HTML. There's no if or loops in CSS. So do be careful to know that they are not programming languages, but they are languages. We have HTML, which is a markup language, which allows us to take simple text and have it do different things on our page depending on what set of tags it is in between. If I put hello world in between title tags, it's gonna show up in the title bar on my browser. If I put hello world in between body tags, it's gonna show up in the window. If I put hello world in between B tags, it's gonna show up in bold somewhere on my window. So that allows me to mark up text or provide additional semantic meaning to plain text. But really that's all HTML is doing. Sometimes those tags determine where on the page something is going to be. Sometimes they determine what it looks like, but that's all it is doing, is applying some additional meaning to text. CSS is a styling language and is more commonly used for the look and feel of your pages. So you can use HTML tags to change the color of things with various attributes in your tags, but most commonly nowadays we use CSS to do this at a sort of a higher level, applying to perhaps more than just a single page, but to multiple pages that comprise a site. We can apply a single style sheet to all of those pages to make all of the text inside of certain divs with a certain ID look red or something like that. And we can do this with CSS selectors and attributes. And we're not gonna get into detail now on all the different types of selectors and attributes and all the HTML tags that you could use, because if for whatever reason they show up in the quiz, you can just Google these things. There's plenty of huge lists of these things available. So we don't need to get into a lot of detail on it. But again, the key takeaway here is HTML is content, CSS is look and feel. Neither of these is a programming language, okay? All right, so that's enough about week six. Let's talk about week seven. So week seven was Patrick's lecture at Yale, and it was focused on machine learning. And it was your first actually introduction to Python. You saw some Python examples come up. We didn't get into the syntax and semantics of all of that stuff, but we did see it for the first time. But this lecture was focused, again, pretty much entirely on machine learning, using Python as sort of the vehicle to introduce this concept. Machine learning is a specific field of computer science. So we've been doing a lot of programming. You're learning programming. But computer science is not equal to programming. It's usually using programming to do different kinds of things. And one of these things is to teach computers how to get smarter. And that's what machine learning is all about. And there's you've seen horror movies or dystopian future movies where this gets a little out of hand. And hopefully we won't reach that point, at least in my lifetime. But that's what this discipline is about. It's about using programming not to explicitly solve a problem outright. It is not writing a program that computes the size, that prints out a Mario pyramid of a given height, but rather to do your programming not to solve a problem, but to teach a computer to solve other kinds of problems. So you're writing an intelligence, or you're writing a heuristic. You're trying to teach a computer something. So that's more what the focus of the discipline is. And for people who spend their careers or work in machine learning, that's what their programming is focused on. It's not about solving a specific problem, but how to solve problems more generally. And so if that interests you, machine learning might be an interesting place to continue your studies in the future. We talked about a couple of different types of machine learning. And full disclosure, I am not a machine learning expert in this, so I'm happy to answer any questions about it, but I will, if I do not know the answer to it, I will defer for now, and we will get you a good answer, because this is not the field in which I studied. But we talked about a couple of different types of machine learning problems that are being solved. And the first of these was image classification. And so if you watch the lecture, you remember that what we did in this example was try and teach a computer to recognize whether the digits that somebody is writing. So somebody has handwritten a number and sort of a form of optical character recognition. We're trying to have a computer figure out what they have written by processing that data. And the way that we taught a computer what zeros were and what eights were and what threes were was to use a training set. So there was a set of, you go out and you ask 100 people to write the digits 0 through 9 inside of a little box, right? And in the lecture, we saw that what we did was we took that box and we divided it into 64 smaller boxes. And we looked at how much ink or how much pressure had been applied in each of those boxes to figure out when you're drawing a zero, you're usually coming down pretty hard on the sides, but maybe when you're coming around the corner, maybe your the stroke of your pen is a little bit lighter. This is what we're doing, right? It's not is this a zero? It's more trying to find the patterns in the way that we do things and teach a computer to recognize a pattern, not teach it to recognize just a zero. But we processed this data set, we looked at it, we determined the different, you know, sort of weights or strengths of how dark the pen stroke was, and we put all of that into a giant array, and then we had somebody, you know, somebody goes out and writes a random number inside of another square. And the goal of this whole process is to say, can the computer figure out what number you just wrote? So you're not even typing it in, like it's literally like scanning it, or you're processing some other form of information, but you're not saying like, this is a four, if they wrote a four, you're just saying, what is this? And it does this by looking at all of the training data sets and comparing all of the other numbers it's seen to similar characteristics of what it is seeing over here in this new piece of information that's not part of its training set. And basically what it's doing is a really complex form of a distance formula. It's trying to figure out, you know, and we talked about it being in a 64-dimensional space. But it's really just trying to figure out, like, in the top left corner, like, how similar is it to all of these other numbers? And it does that for not just the top left corner, but also every single piece of that square. So it takes that one square that the user is writing a number into, divides it into 64 pieces, and basically calculates a distance formula from all 64 little different distance formulas to figure out how far away it is from other fours or other threes, and it's trying to figure out, like, based on how close it is to numbers like that fit into this little segment of my world, my 64-dimensional space, like it's probably a three or it's probably a four based on that. And so that was just black and white images. Like, that's complicated already. But we want to go further than that, and so we can introduce the concept of color images and images being rotated. All of these are problems that machine learning experts are trying to solve. They are certainly not the kinds of problems that we're going to expect you to solve on the quiz, but these are the kinds of issues that are coming up. So do know things like what is a training set, or what is a data set, or what exactly is happening when we're trying to figure out is a number this, or how similar is it to other things in the data set? That's what this whole problem that's being solved in this case is really just figuring out how close is it to something I know, but you're not necessarily gonna have to write the code that solves that problem. Deep learning takes this one step further. In addition to recognizing, it tries to do pattern recognition sort of on a grander scale. So deep learning involves things like Siri and Cortana and Google Now and all these things that process little pieces of speech and figures out, like, okay, well, if I'm saying this, like, a really common thing to do after you say this particular phrase is to add this word, and maybe what you're doing is actually asking me, like, what time is this particular movie playing, and it can tell you. So it's trying to take together these small pieces that it can recognize and then figure out, like, okay, well, these two pieces usually go side by side, so they're part of some bigger entity, so I can treat that as one thing. And basically just taking these small patterns and building them up, so that it can learn more and more complex phrases without necessarily having to relearn everything. It doesn't have to relearn an entire new phrase. It can learn a phrase by taking together smaller pieces that it already knows. And it can process all those individual pieces together into a single new piece of information. That's what deep learning is all about. It's about layering information. So again, we're not training it anymore to recognize higher, more complex phrases, or instead of recognizing just somebody's nose, like recognizing a face, like, no, like what deep learning is about is like recognizing when I see a nose, like typically what I'm gonna see above it is eyes, and if I see something that looks like eyes up there, like now I can layer that into saying like this is a face. But I didn't ever have to train it into knowing what a face is. I just needed to train it to know what a nose is, what eyes are, and that they should generally be, you know, the eyes should generally be above the nose or somehow relative to the nose if the image is like turned sideways or something like that. Deep learning is about computers recognizing those kinds of patterns. And the last problem that we talked about was text clustering. And you've actually done this. You did text clustering. This was PSET 6. In PSET 6, we did it into, clustered text into three buckets, happy, sad, or neutral. But you can do this in a much more complex way. You can look through whole books and you can decide, I'm looking for maybe these 20 words. And you can use text clustering to figure out whether two texts are similar based on how many times words of this particular type appear versus how many times words of this particular type appear. Again, we did this in PSET 6. It was just happy words, sad words, or neutral words, and you overall categorized a tweet based on as happy, sad, or neutral based on how many times individual words in there were happy, sad, or neutral. So it's just taking that and applying it on a bigger scale. Maybe you want to characterize, love movies, romance movies, and horror movies, and thrillers, and comedies. And maybe you do that by looking for, you have a list of comedy words, and a list of horror words, and a list of romance words, and you are trying to run all of these movie scripts through to figure out, well, how would you generally categorize this just by looking at the script? That's what text clustering is about, that sort of problem. Okay, so questions on that? All right, so then week 8, we moved to Python. What's cool about this, though, is that all the stuff we already knew still applied. So we still have variables, conditions, loops, lists. They're called lists in Python, but they're just arrays. The syntax has changed, but the fundamentals don't. And this is you're going to find this to be the case regardless of what other languages you might go on to learn. If you decide after taking CS50 that you want to take more classes or learn more about computer science, you'll find that, for the most part, the fundamentals don't change, just the syntax does. And in some languages, it might look really different, but the rules are still the same at the end of the day. We learned a couple of other new things. We learned about tuples, which are basically immutable lists, almost, sort of. They're not really lists, but it's a collection of information that can't be changed. So perhaps like a coordinate in space is always going to be at 2, 3, 1 or something, right? That's a tuple, because that piece of information, that 2, 3, 1 is, we need all of its pieces at once, and it's not going to change. That is always the location of that particular point. What?
There's no back support.
Oh, sorry. There are sets. We have things called dictionaries, which allow us to have key value pair mappings. So we can, we no longer are we restricted to being able to refer to array locations or indexes by numbers. If we have a dictionary of information, we might be able to say something square bracket course instead of square bracket 2 or something like that. So we can associate keys with values. And then we have objects and classes. So in Python, we were able to start introducing the concept of object-oriented programming. And we learned that objects are really similar in spirit to structures in C, and that they can have a number of attributes inside of them. But they can also have methods inside of them. And methods are functions that can only be called on objects of that class or of that type. So it's not a function that is generally applicable anymore. It is a function that only means something in the context of I have an object of class student, or I have an object of class car. Maybe there are only certain things that I can do. And we have methods that are defined inside of the class that will only apply to those objects, which are, again, really similar to structures. Python also introduces something called an interpreter. An interpreter allows us to sort of skip the step of compiling our code. So when we did all of our work in C, we had to compile our code, which was this extra step of turning it from the words or sort of words that we understand as the C programming language into zeros and ones, which computers understand. In Python, we don't have to do that. We can run our code through the Python interpreter. And the Python interpreter, what that does is it basically saves us that step. There's a program called Python, which is the Python interpreter, and it basically does the same thing. It translates Python code into zeros and ones, because still, even though it's Python, it's a higher level language, computers still only understand zeros and ones at the end of the day. But it sort of does it on the fly as your program is running. And it's instead of compiling it to machine code, it compiles it to something called bytecode, and we don't need to get into details on what the difference between those things are. But at the end of the day, they boil down to zeros and ones, just like they did in C. But we don't have to do this step of making our programs or using Clang to transform our Python code into Python executables. We can just have a Python file, we save it, and we can immediately rerun it without having to do this extra step. That's called interpreting, or an interpreted file or program. Python also introduces us to higher level languages. So C is what's known as a very low level language. You can do really, really low level operations, like telling a computer, like accessing a specific location in memory via a pointer and changing what you find there. That is a very low level operation. Or even doing things like freeing memory. That is a low level operation. But it gets really complicated to do more complex things like building a hash table, right? A hash table is basically a built-in data type in Python. It's a dictionary. A hash table is really just a dictionary. And so what Python allows us to do is to take all of these things that we learned in the first half of the class for granted. These now exist. I don't have to re-implement these things. They're done for me. And from that, now we can solve more interesting and more complex problems because we don't have to worry about spending 40% of our time or 80% of our time doing the foundational work to get set up. I mean, compare and contrast the spell checker that you wrote in Problem Set 5 to the spell checker Python example that we saw in lecture. The latter was maybe, what, 19 or 20 lines of code, and your implementation of dictionary might have been 200 or so lines of code. And that's just because in a lower level language, we have to do so much more work to build up to these more complex things that are really useful to us. Python also, you can do this in C too. You can do web programming in C, but it's not a picnic at all. In Python, we start to talk a little bit more about web-based software. And web-based software accomplishes many, many, many different goals. I've only outlined three here, but maybe some of the things we might want to do with web-based software, since users will be visiting our pages via a web browser, we probably want to have that software dynamically generate HTML. So instead of just serving them up a static page that never changes, we wouldn't need Python to do that. We could just write HTML directly and say, like, welcome to my homepage. This is never going to change. I didn't need to write that in Python. I can just write that in HTML. But maybe I want to have the user submit a form. Maybe Rob visits my site and he types his name into a form and maybe it says, hello, Rob, thank you for visiting my webpage. Like, now my page has been dynamically generated. Maybe that's something I want to do. That's a really simple example, but we couldn't do that with just HTML. We'd have to have something else to process what came in via that form. Maybe we want to be able to respond to data requests, like the one I was, again, just using as an example. Maybe Rob submitted a form. It was submitted via HTTP post, or maybe HTTP get. And I want to be able to process that. I can't just extract information from a field in HTML. I have to use some other language to help me with that. Maybe I want to abstract out repetitive stuff. So this is what's known as templating, and we saw this in PSET 6 and 7, and a little bit in 8 as well. Maybe we want to have certain parts of our page that we display or that are really static or don't change very much, and maybe we want to render those parts separately from the parts that are dynamically generated. Again, we need logic. We need an actual programming language to allow us to make these decisions. And Python allows us to do that in a web-based context. And there are many other languages that you can use to program web-based software. Certainly PHP is the other one that might be familiar to you. But Python is not the only one you can use. We also talked about the MVC paradigm. So MVC is not a programming language as well. MVC is basically a system of rules or best practices that over the years people who designed websites sort of standardized on as the best way to organize your page. Yes?
Can you talk about HTTP post?
Sure. So the distinction between HTTP get and post. So the most fundamental way to describe it is that when you're submitting information to a page via the HTTP GET request, you're basically requesting a particular URL, and the information that you are passing is sent via the URL. So my GET request to Google might contain the query that what I was searching for. I have to send that as part of the URL in my request. In HTTP POST, the difference is that our data is sent via HTTP headers, which is different than having it show up in the browser, but it is not secure. There's a common misconception that HTTP GET is less secure than HTTP POST, and it's really only through security by obscurity. But if you have a modern web browser, you can open up and see exactly what your HTTP request out was. And your HTTP request has headers at the top of it that say where it's going and all this stuff. And I said earlier, maybe it has some other stuff with it. Some of the other stuff that might be with it is actually the stuff you submitted via a form. And so when you should actually do this sometime. You should go to a website and try and log into Facebook and have Chrome console open. So you can then take a look at the headers that were sent over. Type in your username, type in your password, and take a look at the HTTP headers that get sent. It might surprise you to know that your password is possibly going through, depending on the security of your site, in plain text out there, so that somebody who is sophisticated enough to know to look at the headers, you know, it's clearly not good to send it through the URL, right? Because if you're sitting there next to somebody on your machine, you're typing information, and they can just read what your password is, like, that's probably not so great. But if somebody is out there listening for traffic and seeking, trying to read those headers as they come through, they might be able to get your password because the data is being passed in sort of, it's still being passed in via HTTP, it's just being passed in a tiny bit more in a hidden way, but not completely hidden. HTTP header is the is basically the stuff I was talking about earlier, like HTTP GET slash all that stuff, like the stuff that you don't actually see behind the scenes when you, or the stuff that you're not receiving, you don't see that you're receiving. But it's sort of the handshake aspect, like, hi, I'm about to send you an HTTP request. Like, here's all the stuff in the format that you're expecting it to be in, and then you actually submit your request. So I'm telling you, like, this is a GET request. I'm using HTTP protocol 1.1. I want to visit this particular host. Here's my return address, all that stuff. That's all in the headers. But none of that, you don't actually write any of that when you're submitting a request, right? The only thing that you write maybe is www.google.com, and you're expecting a response back. But the headers are sort of the metadata that are associated with that, that you don't do, your browser handles for you, but is an essential component of sending the request along, such that, because if I just type www.google.com and like throw it out into the ether, like, no one's gonna know what to do with it. I have to provide additional wrapper information for that to work. I have to provide, in this example, an HTTP header, which says, this is an HTTP request, here's the format that you prescribe, this is that I want to see, here's the return address to send it to. It's all this metadata that your browser does for you.
So basically, when you're thinking about the difference between post and get, get the data is in the URL. Post, it's not visible in the URL. So think of like the advantages and disadvantages that come with that. So if I wanted to send someone a link to, let's say, just Google results. So I go to Google, type into the search box, hit enter. They happen to use a get request. So that means that like my search queries and all that sort of stuff is going to appear in the URL. That means that I can copy that URL and send it to someone, and when they click on the link, they'll see the same thing. If they used a post request, then my search terms and all that would not appear in the URL, and I wouldn't be able to send that link to someone. You also wouldn't be able to bookmark something that is the result of a post request. But alternatively, you might have a post request. Let's say you just purchased something on Amazon. So that ideally wouldn't be something that every single time you visit that link, it repurchases the item. So, or if you sent that link to someone, it would purchase the item for you. A post request is common if you try to reload a page and you see that little pop-up that says, would you like to confirm form resubmission? That's an indicator that this must have been a post request, because if it were a get request, it would all just be in the URL and there wouldn't be any real danger to reloading the page.
Yeah, so when you like Google something and you see like a question mark Q stands for query, and then equals and like all your search terms, that's like the get request, and that's like all the parameters that are passed in through that get request. But you don't see that when you're submitting like something like Rob mentioned through a post request.
Both of them are they're really quite similar, and they're both, like I said, there's sort of a misconception that post is more secure, but it's only more secure in as much as it doesn't throw possibly sensitive information into a URL. But certainly with browsers now, where we have like developer tools and inspectors and stuff like that, we can actually see that like our passwords get sent, usually in the clear. Like it's
like if Facebook login were a GET request, and then if someone were looking over your shoulder, they could see your password in the URL. So that's why it's a post request.
But now if they're sitting by and you get up to go, you know, get a drink of water, and they like open up your console and like take a look at the HTTP request that you just sent, they can still see the password that you typed in, even though it showed up as all stars in the little box when you were typing it in. But it does allow data to be transferred. Usually, you can also use post to do other things like transfer like files and stuff that you can't obviously transfer in a URL very
easily.
Yeah,
that's true. That like a URL ultimately has a length limit of like, I don't know, 65,000 characters maybe, and a post request can be basically arbitrarily large.
But they're both used to pass information, just the vehicle by which it does it is slightly different. Okay, so MVC, quickly to distinguish what these three things are, like I said, this is a paradigm that folks who program a lot for web software a lot have decided is a good way to separate out the portions of your website. You have things called controllers. Sometimes it's usually referred to as a single controller, but maybe it's multiple files. That's where all of your logic happens. So your controller, and again, this is not a definitive rule, but as a general rule, the controller is going to be where like your Python code will be. That's where the decisions are made. I'm visiting a particular, maybe I have a decorator at the top of my file, app.route search. And if I see that, I'm going to execute the search function, and I maybe have ifs and loops and stuff in there. Like that's all in my controller. My view are the things like the templates that you generated for PSET 7. That's usually, but not entirely, HTML. That's the stuff that your user actually sees. So remember, your user is never seeing Python code when they visit. They're only ever seeing templates that you have generated. You always call that render template function at the end of every decision-making block in Problem Set 7. So what that was doing was your controller was deciding which view to show the user. The view is the stuff the user actually sees, and the model is the back end of your site. In PSET 7, that's your SQLite table, your database. Sometimes it can just be a CSV. It's where data is stored, and you generally never want to give your users direct access to that because they might do something like a SQL injection attack or something really terrible, or just manipulate it wildly. You generally want all requests to your database to come via your controller. Your controller should make sure that all of your data is escaped, and make sure that they're not trying to do anything malicious, but you don't give the user generally direct control of the model. You only do it indirectly through your controllers and your views. We talked about Flask. We introduced Flask at the end of week 8, which is a web micro framework for building simple web applications. It is actually very, very small, Flask, but it does some very, very powerful things that would be really annoying to have to implement ourselves. So you may remember from the end of week 8's lecture that David built a very simple web server without using Flask, using some of the other stuff that is built into Python. And there was a lot of really weird looking code in there and a lot of really minor detail, like 20, 30 lines of code, which in Python might, in C wouldn't have been that much, but maybe in Python it's a lot considering in Python it's a higher level. But it was just to get it to say hello world. Well, Flask takes some of the really annoying detail and abstracts it away. How to handle page redirection, so you don't have to write the code that handles, okay, well now I want to send the user to this page. Without Flask, you'd have to write that yourself. You'd have to tell the user, you have to write some code that would send the user to a different page at the end. And thanks to Flask, they did that for us, and we can just say redirect, and then we tell them where we want to redirect them to. How to generate page templates, we'd have to do that ourselves if we didn't have access to a framework. How to determine the URL of a particular page. We use that URL_for function quite a lot. Instead of having to specify exactly a URL, we just said, well, you go figure out what the URL is because that's a cool feature and I don't want to have to specify exactly what I should be visiting. And we also, in this context, learned about decorators and how they are little lines of code that we put above in the context in which we're using them in CS50. It's a little line of code we put above a function call to associate a function with a particular route. So if I want to only call the search function in my Python code when a user visits my site /search, I put a little decorator atop of that that's like at app.route parentheses search. And so that function will only get called when I'm visiting the search page on my site. Decorators can do lots of other cool stuff, but you don't need to get into that detail now, but know that that's what we use them for in CS50. So last week we talked about SQL, the structured query language. SQL is a programming language, although it's not as perhaps fully fleshed out as something like its utility is a bit more limited, but it is a programming language. It does have conditions. You can do if something, you can repeat things. So that is a distinction from it and HTML and CSS. It is a language that is used to make queries or requests to a database. So generally when you're using SQL, you are seeking to extract some set of information from your model, from your database, and get it back. Get back whichever rows match your query or whichever columns match your query. But SQL is not the database itself. SQL is a language, and there are many different database packages that are designed to respond to SQL requests. So you things have like MySQL, PostgreSQL, Access, Oracle, and in the case of one we use this year, SQLite. Those are databases or database software, but SQL is not itself database software. The other feature of SQL databases is that they are relational. They allow you to establish relationships across different tables, so you can associate data that is in the student's table with data that is in the professor's table, perhaps just make some sort of relationship between those two things, even though they're not in the same table. We can make these sort of cross-references. And the acronym to keep in mind with SQL is that it is CRUD, which stands for Create, Read, Update, and Delete Data. These are sort of the core functionality that we require in order to work with a database. We need to create databases and tables and also create new data to put into them. We need to be able to read or select information from our database, change what we find there, and get rid of it when we no longer need it. There are four basic queries that we talked about in the course: select, insert, update, and delete, and they have these extra sort of words that are associated with them. So select star means to select an entire row. You can also select certain columns from a particular row if you don't need the entire row. Like maybe it's like my name and my date of birth and where I live, and maybe you only really care about my name, so you just want to select my name as long as you find this particular, you know, email address or something. You don't need to select the entire row. Yes. No, you could do it all lowercase. Generally, at least when I write all of the keywords in capital to distinguish them from the things I'm looking for, which are generally going to be in lowercase. But no, you can write everything in lowercase, that'd be fine. Yes? So a primary key is basically you've decided that this is going to be the column that decides, that is, that I'm going to use when selecting data.
So ultimately, a primary key
is a unique column.
It's just the difference between the primary key is the one that you are saying, like, this is the fundamental one I want to, like, sort the data on, select data using. But consider, like, you can make, like, an email address column unique. And an email address is, like, a text field of, I don't know, 255 characters compared to a primary key that is an integer that's only like 4 or 8 bytes. The database can ultimately use an integer. It can deal with integers much more quickly than it can deal with an email address column of 255 arbitrary characters. So, like, that's where you might have a unique column that's not ideal to be a primary key just because, like, just because it's unique doesn't mean that it's like ideal to completely use to determine the uniqueness of rows, to select and sort rows.
In that example, it would be perfectly legit to use the email address as the primary key, but it does make querying operations. Like if I'm looking for something where email address equals a particular email address, it's harder to search, to do that sort of search on everybody's email address versus if you've logged in and you've sort of set, somehow you've cached a user's ID number. It's a lot easier to say, like, find row 17 versus find the row where a user's email address is, you know, this 45 character.
And think anytime you wanted to join two tables, or consider in PSET 7 when you wanted to select from the transactions table based on the user ID, what if instead of using user ID, you use the user email, which was unique? So now all of a sudden, like, you're storing the user email, which is unique, in both the users table and in the transactions table, the history table, just because that's what you happen to be using as the primary key. But it's easier to just use this integer primary key all over the place.
Yeah, and primary keys are like most often used when we try to relate tables to each other, just like Rob mentioned, to join tables.
So primary keys are unique, but unique columns are not necessarily primary keys. Yes? Do you always what? I'm sorry. You don't have to. It's probably a good idea to make sure that there's never a problem, but it's not required. Generally, if you're setting up a primary key in your table, you will just have it auto-increment, so you don't have to worry about that detail. Specifying a column as null or not null, sometimes you don't have to put information into a, maybe it's, you know, the user's zip code or phone number or something. Like when you're filling out a form, like maybe it's one of those fields that doesn't have a star next to it, so you don't have to type it in. So that basically, if you specify that column as not null, it's going to force you to have to put in a phone number for everybody. If you allow that column to be null, then it's okay. I can still insert a user who didn't provide their phone number because they didn't want to. PHP LightAdmin is a web-based tool that we use to help manage our databases. Generally, you're going to use it to set up your initial schema, which is basically saying what the names of all my columns are, what data types they accept, and then all these extra things like, does it auto-increment? Is it allowed to be not null? Is it unique? Is it primary? You generally will do all of this. You don't have to. You can do all this from the command line, but you might want to do all this in a graphical setting, just because it's more user-friendly and easier to use. And that's what PHP LightAdmin is. It's not its own language. It's not SQL itself. It is just it's a wrapper. It's a front end for making the process of some SQL queries easier to use. Of course, in CS50, most of our work was done using Python to prepare SQL queries and execute them via Python. Okay, we're almost done. We talked a little bit earlier about joining tables. We might discover as we're putting a lot of information into our database that there is a lot of redundancy. The example that we used in lecture that is probably the easiest to understand is zip codes. Right? So if we're asking a user to input their address, we're getting their street address, we're getting their city, their state, their zip code. But the zip code, in the United States anyway, pretty much always implies the city and state. So maybe we don't need to keep saving the city and state of every user. Maybe we just need to store their zip code. But we don't want to discard the information. We still want to know where they live. And so we could have another table where we store, in the first table, we store name, address, like street address, and zip code. That's one table. In the second table, we might store zip code and city and state. So now I'm in a situation where I've probably done some efficiency in my table because I'm not storing Cambridge, Mass for every single person who registers from Cambridge. I'm just storing 02138. But I still want to get that information later on. Now I have to join. I have to make a connection where I say, if I want to get that user's city and state, I have to take a look at my user's table, figure out what their zip code is, and then based on that, use that zip code to join information from this other table where I'm storing the city and state. So a join is really just taking and combining information from two different tables, or perhaps even two different multiple databases, factoring out common stuff. And then recombining it when we need it. We talked really briefly about what an ORM is. An ORM is an object relational mapper. You don't need to know too much about this, but basically there does exist the possibility in programming languages with tools called ORMs, and one common one is SQL Alchemy, where you can actually make SQL calls using Python. In the case of SQL Alchemy. So I don't have to actually write SQL to make database queries, because what is happening behind the scenes is SQL Alchemy is mapping my Python code into relational database code SQL, right? So object relational mapper, you can think about it as object-oriented programming and a relational database, and there's some piece of software or code that makes this connection between these two things, which are not really necessarily congruous. So I basically, again, what is happening is I'm writing Python code to make SQL queries. And I can only do that thanks to the ORM, which behind the scenes, much like Flask is doing all of these sort of low-level operations for you, is behind the scenes is translating the Python code that you're writing. You're making certain function calls, and it's translating them into SQL queries and querying your database for you. Yes? Not having to mix languages up, like it might look kind of weird if you were skimming through PSET 7, like just suddenly see like these long SQL queries appearing in the middle of your Python. If you get into a mindset of writing something, you might just get used to writing Python. You can just keep going with it. It's certainly not required. You can get away without ever using one. It's really just a convenience tool for a programmer who wants to just get into the mindset of a particular language and just keep using that language throughout.
Yeah, there's also like subtle differences between a lot of the SQL flavors, like MySQL and Postgres and other SQL implementations. that an ORM can potentially differentiate between those for you so that you don't need to know the differences. Like, the ORM knows which underlying SQL implementation you are using, and so it will translate your higher level ideas into the appropriate select queries and the like.
All right, the last thing we talked about in week 9 was SQL injection attacks. The takeaway here is that it is possible to write a SQL query or to submit information to a form in particular that looks like a SQL query to try and trick the database into doing something it is not supposed to do. And we need to make efforts to defend against things like that. And the db.execute function that we provide for you in the CS50 library does this for you, but there are other things you can do, like escaping single quotes so it doesn't look like you're cutting off the example that we saw in lecture with the password trick, trying to get around that, is perhaps the best example, just to take a look at it, seeing it side by side. We only have a few minutes left, but that's okay, because week 10 is the freshest material in your mind, hopefully. And in week 10, we talked about JavaScript. Much like Python, the concepts are all the same, but the syntax and the minor details change a little bit. JavaScript, Python has this too, but JavaScript also has anonymous functions, and we saw this much more in PSET 8. Anonymous functions are functions that do not have names, and it seems kind of weird to do that. Like, how can you write a function if you don't know how to call it? But the reason is, in JavaScript and in Python, we can pass functions as parameters to other functions. And we don't necessarily have to have predefined the function. We can actually define the function. You know, we have this list of like 3 comma separated things. Like, maybe the second one is a function. We can actually define an entire function in between those commas, and that would be perfectly fine. Anonymous functions are most commonly going to come up in the context, in two contexts. Event handlers and callbacks, which are very, very similar in spirit. Event handlers are functions that respond to particular things happening on your page. So maybe a button is clicked, or you just start typing into a field. You can write a function and register an event handler. In JavaScript, it's you're just like writing code and associating it with particular divs or sections of your page, such that that function will get called when that thing happens. Callbacks are really, really similar. The best example from lecture of a callback is when David showed the example of rewriting the blink tag. In that case, it's not necessarily that when things were getting toggled on and off, that we were responding to a particular event happening on our page. We were really just waiting for a particular amount of time to transpire before we called the function again. So that's that. Event handlers and callbacks are sort of similar, but callbacks are not necessarily responding to an event. They might just be things that are just happening in the background, and they might just be an anonymous function. When you're writing JavaScript, you can write it inside of script tags. So JavaScript and HTML play really nicely together. You can open up a script tag and start writing JavaScript inside of it. That's pretty cool. But you can also write your JavaScript in separate JS files and write your JavaScript there, and then just sort of, it's like the equivalent of a pound include or import in Python. You can link it in using script tags, the source attributes. You can write all of your JavaScript in a JavaScript file as opposed to writing it inside of your HTML. In terms of why you might want to do one or the other, well, if you're writing just a tiny, tiny bit of JavaScript, like maybe you don't want to have a separate source, maybe you just want to put it right there in your HTML. But if your site has many different pages and maybe all of those pages rely on this JavaScript function, you might want to write your JavaScript in a separate function and link it in so that you don't have to keep writing that function over and over and over in between script tags on every single page of your site. JavaScript also has this thing called the document object model. We talked about the document object model actually in week 6 when we talked about organizing a page. The HTML page structure is very tree-like. You have a document, you have a head and a body. Inside of the head, you might have a title, you might have your script tags, you might have other stuff, all of that sort of metadata. And then you might have a body, which might have several paragraphs, which might contain links, which might have other things in them. And you can sort of have this tree structure. In JavaScript, you can actually take advantage of this tree structure to modify your page on the fly. Ajax, I know we're just about out of time, but Ajax is another extension of functionality that allows you to submit additional HTTP requests, and this again is usually done via JavaScript, without refreshing the page. It's not always necessary to use Ajax to do something. It's usually used to create a more enjoyable user experience. So if you're a person who watches football games, for example, because I was doing this last night, or maybe you have a score tracker on your phone, it's kind of annoying if you're watching the play-by-play happen on the page and it keeps refreshing every few seconds, like the whole page keeps reloading. Like, that's kind of annoying. But Ajax allows us to do things, to submit asynchronous small requests to maybe just every few seconds take a look at at what the current score is, and if it's changed, just update this tiny little section of my page. So I don't have to refresh everything. I'm just basically doing a refresh on a particular section of my site. That's what Ajax allows us to do. jQuery is a library for JavaScript. It is not its own language, although it looks totally weird. It looks like it might be its own language, but it's not. It's a library for JavaScript that is usually used to do DOM manipulation, to change our page using JavaScript more succinctly, because you can have like a document.get element by ID, blah, 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 and then maybe some more stuff going on from there. It can get very lengthy. jQuery shortens those at the expense of perhaps being a bit more difficult to understand. It's also great because it's cross-platform, so you don't have to deal with any browser idiosyncrasies. The fact that Chrome does something different than Internet Explorer and JavaScript, if you're not writing straight JavaScript, if you're writing jQuery, it handles all of that for you. Lastly, APIs. So APIs are deliberately sort of the note that we end on in CS50 because it opens the door for you to stand on the shoulders of those who came before you. An API is a suite of functions that do a particular thing behind the scenes. Just like you used the CS50 library, you can think of that as a form of an API. You didn't need to know how getString worked. You could just rely on the fact that it did. This concept extends more generally to an API, where Google has provided an API that says, if you want to create a map, these are the functions you can use. Here's how you use them. Don't worry about how exactly we do it on our side. Just know that as long as you're using this function and you're calling it in this way, it will behave the way that you expect. APIs are awesome because when other people solve a particular problem, they may open up their API to you to use, and you can use it to solve more complex problems. And that's really what CS50 is all about. It's about empowering you to learn other, it is not about teaching you programming languages, it's about learning how to rely on resources and tools provided by others. It's about learning a skill set, not a particular, not an individual skill. It's about how to build your own skill set with some ideas. With that said, that's all I've got for the quiz review. Rob and Marie and I will hang out up here if you have any further questions. Otherwise, good luck on the quiz tomorrow, and we'll see you next Monday for the last lecture.